Call a meeting to order. Quorum's present. Representative Murdoch, move the minutes, February 22nd.
Yes, I will.
Any addition or corrections to the minutes? There being none, all in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. First bill up, House File 3126, Representative Cornish. And Representative Cornish, the chair will move the bill. Well, actually, you can move your own bill, and it'll be for possible inclusion in the Game and Fish bill. Welcome. And I didn't wear my enforcement pin today. I left it at home.
Me?
We, Mr. Chair and members, my testimony will be relatively brief. House File 3126, what I am attempting to accomplish here is to remove any height restrictions on deer stands and moose and elk. Eons ago, there was a, this restriction has changed about three times. For those of you that don't hunt, for hunting big game or moose, elk, or deer, the height restriction used to be, I think, 6 feet, then it went to 9 feet, and then to 16 feet. It changed about three times just in my short lifetime as a hunter. And right now, on a permanent stand, as high as you can go is 16 feet. And a permanent stand could be anything from a ladder to a 2x4s or a box built in a tree. The highest you can go is 16 feet. However, portable stands can go any height you want. And I've seen some people take a foot grate and a couple of chains and prop it up with a couple of tubes of aluminum and put it up in a tree. Basically, you could go any height you want to. So to me, it didn't make any sense at all to have no height restrictions on portable stands, which can be homemade and rickety and be up the high as in a cottonwood tree 100 feet, where you have to use an oxygen tank to get there. And you can only go 16 feet on permanent stands. This bill is basically about, you know, permanent or about personal responsibility. What you'll see in a parallel here is, you remember Representative Dills and I, my bill about uncased guns. This is kind of following the same path, where it's just about personal responsibility. And you're going to see somebody maybe from the DNR testify against it and somebody from Capable Partners. In the end, if this bill passes, it'll be favored by a huge majority of sportsmen. I've had just a few emails and calls that I've had already say it makes absolutely no sense when you can take a portable stand as high as you want and permanent stands only can go 16 feet. And as far as aesthetics or what it looks like in the woods, that time of the year all the leaves are off the tree anyway, and you can see the stand whether it's 6, 12, or 100 feet. So to me, it's just, it doesn't make any sense anymore to have this here. If you can go high as you want with a portable, then why in the world have we got any restrictions on the permanent stands? A couple of comments I heard on the way in here, nobody came and talked to me about the bill, even though it's been on here, and somebody said, well, what about a 12-year-old kid that gets up in the stand? Well, what about it? I mean, if you're 12 years old, you're probably going to hunt with your parents. If you're 14, you can hunt alone. I mean, if they want to crawl up, but right now we got kids crawling up in a cottonwood tree 50 feet down in my area. I mean, in a portable stand, why not have them, you know? So what? What about a 12-year-old kid? The Capable Partners might testify. My brother has been in the wheelchair for 20, 30 years, and the quadriplegic, we've helped him hunt, and we either put him on a plywood on the ground or we put a block and tackle on him and hoist him up in a tree. And I don't think they should have any more height restrictions on them than we do on us. And so I don't know where either of these arguments are coming from, but like I say, it's kind of a culture shock. It's been like this so long, everybody looks at it and goes, whoa, how can we not have any height restrictions anymore? It's similar to the uncased gun. Since 1919, it was like that, and people went, whoa. Well, now it passed, and the sportsmen are gladly accepting it. So with that, I'll pause and let you bring anybody you want to the table.
Question for Representative Cornish from the members. Representative Salem.
Representative Dill. Yes, I would just, or Chair Dill, sorry. For Representative Cornish, I would just like to, give you mention a little feedback actually that I've had from some constituents, and I think you brought it up yourself, and that's with regard to permanent versus the removable stands, and that being aesthetic issues. I've actually had that issue raised because, as many of us have driven around in areas where stands are located, obviously the ones that are on four, that are many palaces, as I've often heard people speak of, are certainly much more intrusive, if you will, and that's the objection that I've heard from people, is that those stands that are freestanding, and if they're taller than 16 feet, they obviously stand out a lot more than something that is actually attached to the tree, leaves or no leaves, and that's just a concern that's been brought to my attention, and I wondered if you had heard that from anyone.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, yes, I have, and the way I counter that is it seems like there's getting less and less permanent stands to me. Right now, it actually costs you more to build a permanent stand than it does to buy a portable. And at Gander Mountain and several places, you can buy a portable stand for $49, and to put up a similar tree stand is kind of like a fish house. You could spend easily $100 on lumber. And so I kind of discount that. I think that the portable stands, you'll see much more of them now taken up and down, and I don't see, when I go out hunting in the woods, a big problem with the aesthetics or see them in the woods that much. So.
Okay, any other questions from members? Representative Hagberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Cornish, you know the law as a former conservation officer about portable stands and having portable stands on public property. Like in, if you happen to be hunting on a state park or wildlife management area, something like that, or state forest property, if you have a portable stand, you have to take it down every night and then put it back up when you go back out in the morning. I think that is. I'm not sure of the law, and maybe you can clarify it. If I do leave that stand on public property overnight, and I come back and somebody else is in it, then they have a right to be in that stand, and I can understand that. But do you actually have to take it down and then put it back up in the morning when you go back out? Or can you leave it, and then if somebody's in it when you get there in the morning, you just let that person hunt in it?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbart, I believe I'll let enforcement be the final word on this, but I naturally this bill doesn't affect anything to do with that. It's just height. But, you know, and but I believe you still have to take it up and put it down in wildlife management areas. I don't think you can leave it there, but if you're on public land where everybody can go, if you do leave it there, I believe it's just everything from a social agreement to a barroom ball could happen over it. But you know.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, it would be the same if you built a permanent stand on state forest land. If somebody else is in there when you get there in the morning, they have a right to that stand.
Right.
Even if it's a permanent stand.
Permanent or portable. I think if you leave it in the woods on public ground, it's, you know, anybody's claim to whose it is.
Right. Thank you. Could you come down, Mr. Smith, for a minute?
Mr. Chair, one more thing I should add is that there is some type of safety issue. Some people say you're going to reach out further. There's actually a good reverse argument for that, too. The higher up that you're at, the more direct angle you'll be shooting down instead of crossways into the woods, too. So you'll hear all sorts of claims of this and that. So.
Can you welcome and state your name for the record, and then can you give us the rundown on how the public land part works? I think that we know how the private land part works, but can you give us a rundown on the public land, whether it be portable or permanent?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Major Rodman Smith, DNR Enforcement Operations Manager. For the public land, Mr. Chair and members, it little differentiates a little bit on what kind of land you're hunting on between for example, wildlife management area, if you put up a portable stand, that stand has to be taken down every night, then you put back up. On other public lands, as far as maybe state forest land, if a portable stand was put up overnight, it is public property, and somebody that put it up that who owns the stand necessarily would not be able to claim ownership of it the next day. Somebody else could get in there ahead of them and get up on that stand.
Representative McCord.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that is true, then, like Representative Cornish said, if it's a permanent stand built on state forest land and somebody else was in it, they would have the right to be in that stand.
Mr. Chair.
Permanent stand also.
Representative, you are correct.
When you said, I forget just how you phrased it, something about ownership. You said something about when they arrived, when they put it on public land and erected and left it overnight, that they wouldn't be able to claim ownership of it. You meant that if someone were else in there, they couldn't run them off. But if no one was in there, they could take it down and it would still be their possession. That's, I'm trying to get the difference between ownership and what does that mean?
Mr. Chair, you're correct.
Okay. Anybody have a question on that part?
Could you repeat that, Mr. Chair?
Well, he said in his testimony that when someone came out and found a stand in on public land, that then they, in essence, they would no longer have ownership of that stand.
Yeah.
And what he meant was is that they wouldn't be able to use the stand if someone was else was in it at that time. But if no one was in it or if that person left, they would still have ownership of it. They could take it and remove it and do all of that, and they could use it when no one else was in it. But I was thinking the way you stated that, I don't think you meant it that way. Ownership, meaning you buy a portable stand, put it up, you get out there, you leave it overnight, you get out there, no one's in it, you could take it down right then and haul it back home.
Thank you for the clarification, Mr. Chair.
Well, I just want to make sure we were on the, Representative McNamara.
Well, to that point, but I guess to clarify one step farther, Major, if I put the stand up and came back the next morning and got there late because I slept in a little bit and Representative Murdoch was in the tree, my ownership doesn't allow me to kick him out and take it home at that time, correct? I mean, he's free to stay in there. I was too late. I got to go find a different spot.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, you're correct. If you put the stand up on a public property and you hunt that day, you go home, you leave the stand up, you come back the next day, and Representative Murdoch is in your stand, you still own the stand, but he has the hunting rights to that stand that day, and you wouldn't be able to tell him to take a hike and take your stand and go home. You still retain the ownership of the stand.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Major, would that be true in the case of a duck blind?
On public property.
I'd have to check. Mr. Chair, Representative, let me check into that. I don't want to...
I'm getting a little off track here, but I thought the answer would be yes. I assumed it was, but that's fine. We can save it
I'm
for another day.
I'm almost there, but okay. I don't want to guess.
Okay. Further questions? Did you have testimony you'd like to give on the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, then.
Mr. Chair, members, I handed out some information that is found the first... Part of the information is from our hunting synopsis. It talks about tree stand safety. And the second part, it's two-sided, is the actual link to the website that is referred to on the in the synopsis. And the most recent data the Department of Natural Resources has on tree stand safety is that in 2007 there was a study of about 850 Minnesota hunters that indicated, as you can read here, that 60% knew somebody was injured in a tree stand fall. In addition to that, 84% of those who fell needed medical required medical attention. And basically, the stand of the DNR is the higher you put the stand, the farther somebody's going to fall, which increases the risk of more injuries. Getting rid of the tree stand height restriction is a social issue. Not so much a biological issue as far as managing the deer herd. I've talked with Mr. Bogus about that, and there's nothing to indicate that this is a biological issue or a management issue, more of a public safety and social issue.
So we'd rank that up with abortion? Social issues now in the Game and Fish Committee? Any other questions from the members? Okay, people... Representative Hagbarth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering who this guy is. I mean, maybe we need an introduction.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I mean, he gave an introduction, but he seems new to the legislature.
Oh, well, he's been testifying in our committee the whole season. But go ahead, let's have a little introduction.
I'm sorry.
He's head of social justice programs now at the Department of Natural Resources. Go ahead. Give us your title, a whole nine yards.
Major Rodman Smith. I'm the operations manager for the Division of Enforcement.
Okay. Any further questions of Mr. Smith? Okay. Thank you very much. We may be calling on you again for some more. Mr. Howe. Roger. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Roger Haupt. I reside in Little Canada. I find it difficult to speak against this bill because Representative Cornish has helped us with capable partners for many years, so has this committee, to try and level the playing field so that disabled hunters have less difficulty doing their hunting. I'm with Capable Partners, in case you're not familiar with them. We have programs where those of us who are able-bodied can assist disabled hunters in hunting and fishing and other related opportunities. I originally testified against the 16-foot bill many years ago that Representative Cornish referred to. I did it then strictly for social reasons of people who are handicapped. Most of our hunters who hunt with us are paraplegics or quadriplegics. The quadriplegic, we have quite a few, but the one in the worst physical shape can't move anything but his head. So you can see we have to hunt with him and scout for him and so on. By the way, he has gotten 7 deer and what it's the DNR has also been very, very supportive of our operation. They've given us some special privileges to take care of weather, and particularly weather when most of our members who hunt have no feelings in their legs or arms. I've been hunting deer 64 years. I think that was before you were born, Representative Cornish, personally, I've never needed I've never seen a need for a deer stand, especially one that might be 30 feet high. But my concern is, and I'm sure that of all of our Capable Partners members, is the fall from a stand. And it's fresher in my mind now than it was a year ago, because we just buried one of our members who fell from a stand and was hurt some 15, 18 years ago. And unfortunately, again, our members who are physically disabled have a shorter lifespan, and this one happened to have died in the last 4 months. He may have, when he fell from his deer stand years ago, he may have been hurt badly enough from a 2-foot stand, that is, from when he fell. But the likelihood of it is I think that someone mentioned that Mr. Smith recommended, or man mentioned that the higher the stand, the more they're going to get hurt. Representative Cornish mentioned that someone from Capable Partners may testify, and he also mentioned that permanent stands have different qualifications. I would like to mention that permanent stands normally have wood steps, and the portable stands normally have welded or bolted metal steps. I think there is a difference. I think that these the portable stands are probably safer and could prevent some falls. I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Questions for Mr. Howell?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Others to testify for or against the bill? Okay. Any other members have any other questions?
I got one more.
Oh, Representative McNamara.
Just real quick, Representative Cornish, is there a height restriction for a bear? Just wondering, that's not noted in your bill.
I don't think so. I don't know. Is there, this one says deer, and the other two that are mentioned are moose and elk. This one just specifically says deer.
Okay.
Will we move it for deer?
Well, it sounds like Mr. Boggess said there is no height restriction for bears, so we don't need to remove that one. Okay.
All right. Representative Cornish.
I guess in ending, what I would ask you to do is look at this picture. This shows a person on a portable stand. Portable stand is so unsafe you'll see a strap around the tree going around his shoulders. That's in case he falls out. And they're usually hanging on a peg or by a chain or a webbing strap. And so if the portable stand is that dangerous, you have to be harnessed up in it. Not too many permanent stands I've seen people in that have a harness around them. So I guess if we're talking safety, I would think a permanent would be much more safe. Right now we've got 9 feet on moose and elk. We've got 16 feet on deer, and it's permanent and high as you want and portable. I think we should just make it real simple, give people their own personal responsibility and let them go wherever they want. Thank you.
Well, Representative Cornish, you know, one of the things that I think that this bill does is not necessarily increases the height in the deer stands, although it might, but the way I read the regulations, the more I read them, it seems to me like one of the things we're going to have to do with conservation officers is go to Menards and buy 25 and 30 foot measuring tapes, because I mean they want to measure a distance from an ATV to shoot a grouse. Now we got to measure the distance of several different types of stands, and you know I'm in favor of the bill just so that we get rid of all those measuring tapes. It's a budget cutting item.
Laser
first off,
laser range finders.
Oh yeah, those are even more expensive, but nonetheless, thank you very much. We'll lay the bill over and go to the next bill. Next bill is House File 1146, Representative Hackbarth. And Representative Hackbarth, you've got the A1 amendment.
Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, I'd move the bill 1146. You recommended pass. I'm not sure where you'd like to send it next.
Okay, and then you want to move the amendment?
I'll move the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, the A1 discussion amendment. On the amendment. There being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, 1146 as amended. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Some of you were at the Moha banquet the other day. I was not. I had another commitment. I think that's the first Moha banquet I've missed in many, many years. I don't know if I've ever missed one, and I feel kind of bad about that. But I did miss it. I wish I had been there. And we did hear Congressman Peterson talk about money that was available for walk-in programs, federal money through the 2008 law that was passed at the federal level that has money available. Members that have known me for a long time have known that I've carried this bill for quite a few years now in different forms, and I've always been very, very interested in creating a walk-in program in the state of Minnesota. It's been refined over the years. We have this outdoor heritage money that I think is the right thing to do with this money. When I was carrying the bill, this was actually part of the constitutional amendment to use that money for a walk-in access program. In your packets, members, you have this Access Minnesota Outdoors plan that was done by the DNR. It's a report that was done. We did that January 2008. And it pretty much explains exactly what the program is and what we hope to accomplish by having it. And based on that and on some other programs throughout the country, Nebraska and North Dakota, South Dakota, some other places also have walk-in programs. So a collaboration of this plan and some of the other things that some of the other states have is the result of the House File 1146. And members, what it really does is pays people that have land, open land for hunting, it gives them a small amount of money to let hunters and fishermen come on their property and hunt and fish, and it doesn't get much simpler than that. We really do tie it to, or make it available for CRP land, different conservation programs that we have in the state of Minnesota. I think that a lot of people also would like to access some of those areas that we are now giving payments to private ownership for setting their land aside for conservation. And this is a little bit extra money that would go to folks like that. And then we would also have access to hunting that property. Right now that's not allowed. And it all runs through Bowser. Bowser does these programs now. So I think it's just an added benefit that Bowser could offer to some of these folks that get a little bit more money, keep land in private ownership. They would continue to pay taxes on that land, and people would also be able to hunt on it. These particular lands, if they receive this payment, would also be signed, and there'd be maps and places where people could access on the internet, etc., to find out where these lands are so they go and hunt on those properties. I'm sure I forgot a number of different things, but I'd be open to questions, Mr. Chairman. I think there's some people that want to speak for or against the bill. I know that I talked to Minnesota Deer Hunters this afternoon. They said they do support the bill.
Questions for Representative Hagbarth? Okay, Representative Hagbarth, if you had a piece of land that was in crep or rim, would you, or if compared to a piece of land that wasn't in any kind of a program, and I were a farmer and I called you up, or a landowner and I called you up and said, I'd like to put it in this walk-in program. Mm-hmm. I've got some acreage that's in crep, some that's in rim, and other that isn't in anything. Would I get more money for the program that's in nothing presently, or would I get the same amount of money for all three types I described?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for that question. It's a good one. We do address that in the bill. We leave that up to Bowser to make that determination. And I think they're the right people to do that. If there's a critical habitat area that is good for deer hunting or pheasants or whatever, I think that should get more money than a piece of land that is just open and maybe formally in just corn or soybeans or something like that. We leave that up to Bowser to make that determination.
Okay, Representative Hansen, you have any questions?
I'm waiting for testimony.
Okay. All right. Anyone? We have Mr. Newstrom. Pardon me? Oh, Tom Peterson. I'm sorry. I flipped the page. Sorry about that. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm a government director at the Minnesota Farmers Union. And a couple years ago, we are opposed to the walk-in access program with a caveat. We're kind of also working on it to see. So I guess we could say we have some concerns about it at this point. We took a position a couple years ago, and we were working with a walk-in access program. Had a lot of meetings with our members about it. At first, I thought it was a good idea. I thought that, it seems simple. We're paying farmers. They're going to get a few extra bucks, open their land. It's voluntary. They can make the choice. But as we got out and talked to some of our members, we started to see some of the things that are in the report. DNR can probably tell you that the hunting access program seemed to work good to the west of the states west of Minnesota, and not as good in the states east of Minnesota. And Minnesota's kind of right in the middle, maybe even just how our state works. So kind of looking at a program on how that works. I also mentioned, since we took a position on this a couple years ago, we haven't changed our position since then, but a couple things have changed. Representative Peterson, Colin Peterson, made the statement about the program, which has kind of got some of our people thinking. We know there's money in the farm bill for it that passed. It'll be available until it's spent. There's a few caveats to that, I believe. And then also the outdoor amendment passed. And kind of some of our members may be interested in doing that, but I've kind of read that might not fit there either. And so that's a discussion for you guys to have. Some of our concerns about the program really have to get down to how the program's put together and timing. You can put together a program that works good. As Representative Hagbarth said, North Dakota, South Dakota have good programs. But some of our members have heard some of the issues. A lot of our members farm right on the borders there. They're very familiar. They own land in North South Dakota. And their concerns tend to be around private property and property rights and enforcement. And I think we've talked a lot about who's going to administer this and how it's going to work. But we also are interested in the enforcement and how that's going to work. So say I don't put the property in, but Representative Hagbarth has a farm and a farmland. He puts the property in, I don't. People go out, they hunt on his property in the walk-in program, but they drift over onto my property. Is, you know, what's the consequences? And that's what we really hear a lot of. The dollar amount is always interesting. Of course, the higher the dollar amount, the more interest there would be in that. Back to the property rights. Another thing we heard from people was some of our members were interested in having homestead versus non-homestead. I believe some states have it where you have to homestead or live there. You can't say live in Edina and then own, you know, a couple hundred acres in Mahnomen County, and you put it in there. So the neighbors who choose not to be in the program, they don't deal with it. You live far away, but the people are coming and hunting there, and you have to deal with that. And so that was a question or an issue. I would mention the report. The page 2 of the report has page 3 of the report actually has the recommendations from DNR. And so if you're going to put together a bill, those are, you know, really good recommendations. The other thing we heard is the parcels that are put in some states. This identifies using corners and marking, you know, programs that are, or parcels that are easy to get at. And so the other thing we heard about was liability. And again, you see that would have to be addressed legislatively. So, but I'm pretty comfortable in understanding that could be taken care of, and making sure that holds up. And so, I just wanted to raise some of those issues about private property rights. We have been revisiting with our members and our farmers about it, and we'll continue to do so. We're opposed to it now. Before a final floor vote or something on this, we may take a different position. We are working with the DNR work group that they have on the bill, and also attended a meeting Senator Chaudhry had on the issue last week. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you, sir.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is more for Representative Hackbarth. I haven't seen this before, but just try to help explain this to me, that what type of a payment would a person expect? I mean, if you are to go in and volunteer for this program, do you have any numbers to give an idea?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Falk, if you look in this, I think it's page seven
of the summary, it gives some examples of other states and what they're paying. And I think it would be something similar to that. It all depends on how much money we actually end up putting into the program and how much money that the Bowser actually gives out. I mean, how many people we actually sign up. So however much money that we're going to appropriate out in legislation, and then however much money is there, and then we leave it up to Bowser to make some of these payments, it would be similar to what we have here that you see in this chart. I would assume it would be something like that.
Mr. Chairman. Actually, page 13 has a really good table on estimations on the cost per acres at paying 5, 10, 15, 20. And, of course, I think even at $3 or $4 an acre, you're going to have some farmers, obviously, or landowners that are interested in it. But the higher it gets, obviously, the more people will be interested in it. But that kind of gives you a...
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just kind of curious about spending this money in this manner, because growing up hunting, there's a lot of people you know that you could go ask if they'd be willing to let you hunt in their land, and oftentimes they're very friendly, and it really, I mean, I don't know if a dollar value would entice them, but there's other people who are very parochial about their land, that they want to keep it for their family or their friends for hunting purposes, and I'm still curious about whether or not that these programs actually work, but I do appreciate you giving some information about it.
Well, thank you, Representative Falk. And Mr. Chairman, I think it's important, particularly on some of these CREP programs that we have and CRP and those kinds of things that Bowser works with. I think there's a lot of hunters and fishermen out there that feel like if we're already making payments to some of these folks to set some of this land away for conservation, that it would be nice to hunt on that property. And I've been hearing that for many, many years that I'm at the legislature. And I think that's what we're really trying to get at, is to be able to do some of those things. And I think some of those people that enter those lands into those conservation programs would allow that to happen if they get a little bit more money.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hackbarth, this fund would be federal and state dollars, as you anticipate?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Yes, it would be, because right now, as Colin Peterson did state, there is money at the federal level that we can access if we have a program in place. But if we do not have a program in place at the state level, we can't access any of those federal dollars. So that's why we're bringing it forward now.
One quick follow-up, but would there be any input from hunting licenses to the fund?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know where they're getting the money from at the federal level or where that comes from. If it's Pittman Roberts money, I'm not sure if it's from their general fund or where they're getting the federal dollars, but not in this program, not in the state program.
Thank you.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hackbarth, have you had any discussions just with regard to what this might do about property value in the future on these properties? Is it going to tend to make their property more valuable that there's an easement to allow people to walk in, or less valuable, thereby kind of reducing the tax base, if you will, in a county? Or have you had any conversations about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Saylor, no, I've not had any of those conversations. I do know that a lot of people think that if your land is in crap or a rim or some of those things, that they think that that makes their land more valuable. And so as far as a hunting access program, I don't know. I have not talked to anybody about that particular angle.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would just be interested if there's anyone out there that maybe has looked into some of those issues. Mm-hmm. If it's something that we might hear, you know, if we're contemplating spending public dollars on putting in, you know, a walking access, and then find out later with a different owner that might have a different viewpoint in the future, that it was something that negatively impacted the property value. I would just like to know if somebody has any thoughts on that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Representative Saylor, I appreciate that. Not only, you know, you have to think about, like Mr. Peterson said, not only the farmland that we're talking about, maybe in central or western Minnesota or anywhere where there's open farmland. That would be one possibility where people would apply for this money, but also in northern Minnesota in the woods, there'd be private ownership up there where people might want to put their land into something like this. And I particularly think that it would enhance the property values up there.
Representative Hansen, I got a question for you.
Well, I was waiting for other testifiers.
I just have a question for you. I want to double check. And with regard to the Lessard money, for example, that's been used to buy the easements, the permanent easements up north on the forested land, those include the ability of the public to hunt. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct on the forest, the large Blandon one.
Right. Yes. So, in essence, we do have a walk-in program in Minnesota. It's just under a different set of guidelines and rules than what Representative Hackbarth is alluding to.
And, Mr. Chair, you could negotiate, I think, in terms of property rights, the bundle of sticks that are there, that the hunting rights are one of those property bundles that you could negotiate with a landowner. And I think that Bowser, maybe they can testify to this, Representative Hackbarth, that they could seek the flexibility to negotiate for the hunting rights, potentially in a CREP easement. But I think the feeling is that it would be very hard to get that right when you are looking at the residual value left on the property. That may be a costly access point. But in terms of the forest legacy easements, the Blandon one does have that access in there.
But I think that as we're looking at these things, we ought to make sure we compare apples and apples. The forest legacy amendments are permanent.
Right.
And what Representative Hackbarth is suggesting in his bill are not permanent, permanent arrangements. In fact, at least in the, I don't know, I don't know exactly, so I hesitate to say exactly, but I know that the parcels out in North Dakota that I'm most familiar with come and go from the program over a period of time. Now, I don't know how frequently that is, and I don't know what the contract lengths were, but I know that in my short time of hunting out there that I've gone to a place where I knew there was a plots field, which is the public access, the walk-in program in North Dakota. It was no longer a plots field. And so then the original underlying value would return, in my estimation, back to its original situation.
I believe so, but I do. Mr. Becker is here from the council, and I think has a copy of the forest legacy easement. So, if maybe not at this moment, but if the committee wanted to see that as an example of how that's the eased is on the forest legacy, that would be available.
And I will acknowledge it was Mr. Peterson that said that Minnesota is kind of on the borderline of how things work. I mean, North Dakota's got what, 700,000 people living in it, and Minnesota's got over 5 million, I think, and it is a kind of a different animal. But I do know that driving in this morning from Grand Forks, there's a lot of open country out there that, you know, at least down 94 that could sure be used, and going west through Wilmer and out through that way out to South Dakota, you know, looks like we could use a program, and just how we get it designed. How about testifiers for or against the bill? Come forward. Must be ready to be passed then, Representative Hagbarth. No one, Representative McNamara, you have a question.
Well, I actually have a couple of questions for Mr. Peterson, if he could come back down. And then maybe while he's on the way, Representative Hagbarth, do you say, just to answer Representative Saylor's concerns, are these similar to both the, I'm mostly familiar with the program in South Dakota where it works real well and allows a number of spots to hunt, and along Representative Purcell's line, you do pay, I think, an extra fee in South Dakota on your license, which potentially we could do in the future on something like this. But to Representative Saylor's point, these are temporary, are they not? Would they be similar to South Dakota where, I'm not positive, Representative Dill, but I think they might be annual in South Dakota. I'm not completely positive, but do you spell out in your bill how long would I, if I owned some land and wanted to open it up, what would be my commitment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I don't believe that we spell out in the bill how long the contracts have to be, but I think we could leave that up to Bowser. I would prefer that they be, you know, 5-year or 10-year easement or something like that, or, you know, 4-year or 6-year, whatever it may be. But I don't think that we'd want to do it just on an annual basis. I think that's cost prohibitive. I think you should do it for a longer period of time than that. But I don't think they should be permanent. I think they should. I'm sorry.
Multi-year
lengths, it says.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that is a good idea, yep. Because as Representative Dill said, it helps to the stability of folks,
right,
knowing where it is, and then it would give the farmer some stability. I've got a couple of questions. Mr. Peterson, I was a little confused. You talked about how the issue would be of people going from one property to the other, but that would be true whether it's in a walk-in program or just private property. We're supposed to know where we're at, and we're not free to go onto somebody else's property, right? I mean, is your concern as a neighbor because there might be more people there now, or how would that be any different? How's that any different than just the situation today?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, correct. You know, and like talking like a WMA or something, you're hunting, and we have the same problem. You know, where we hear. Unfortunately, you know, you have people that wander off, and so concerned about signage. Some states, I think, in their programs sign their properties very well and patrol them very well, and they know, and it's a known enforcement, and other states maybe do not as well. And so that's where we've heard from some of our members is that working on how the signage is going to work, how the enforcement's going to work, what's the penalty if you're continually on my property when you're supposed to be on your property. And just following up with some of that, because it's a new program, new idea, and we're dealing with private property rather than state-owned property, and that gets a little touchy sometimes.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know Representative Hagbarth does have things about how close the signs need to be and those kind of things, and in the Dakotas, they might not quite have as many signs as we would have necessary, and that'd be another reason for Representative Hagbarth's idea that we would make a commitment for a few years to the stability of the program. I think this could really work, and I'm a little surprised. I would think it would be a benefit to farmers. We're not telling them they need to do this, but in this day and age when we're trying to find alternative ways to make farmers have different kinds of income, this is an opportunity for them to say, hey, this would be a good program. And I guess my question would be, you raised one other question I'd like to represent Hagbarth answer that. I understand in South Dakota they deal with a liability issue. Are you dealing with the liability issue, Representative Hagbarth?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, yes, we do have the liability issue in the bill. And I talked to Balzer about this earlier, and they believe that what we do have in the bill does take care of the issue for liability.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Becker, where did you go?
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Bill Becker, Lessard, Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. I'm the executive director.
You'd like to say anything about the bill to start with before we start with questions?
Nope. Go ahead.
Well, you're going to take $20 million out of your account. What do you think of that?
Well, as I understand the amendment, it's $10
million. Well, 10 each year, isn't it?
Well, it's only for 1 year right now.
Oh, okay. Thought I'd just scan it. All right, $10 million. So we're cheap today. How does that work with these temporary, how would that work with these temporary, what I would call temporary non-permanent access easements?
Well, I think to cut to the quick, the question is whether or not, as the author said, paying people to let people on their land results in added protection, restoration, or enhancement. And if you think it does, then it's fine to use these funds for this purpose. And it would be necessary to go back into the council recommendations, revise those, and find the money. If you think that paying people to allow people on their land to hunt doesn't per se result in added protection, enhancement, or restoration of the habitat, then I think we have a problem with using the funds in this fashion.
Okay, questions of Mr. Becker. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Becker, was anything in this bill submitted in the last round of applications?
There was no application that I can recall.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Becker, was there any inquiries to the, either yourself or the chair about such a type of program fitting with the constitutional requirement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, not with regard to the last round of applications. This was discussed in regard to the first round of applications, and the response that I had was very similar to the response I've just given this committee.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hackbarth, I think you know, we have a good goal of trying to provide access, and you made a statement about, you know, what passed the legislature and went to the voters was a little different than what originally your intent was and that others' intent were. And what passed the legislature and was voted on by the voters said only to protect or only to restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forest, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. And it doesn't say for access. For public access in that clause. It says it later when there's fee title acquisition, but that is different, and I want to be clear to everybody in the audience, that's different than what some of the versions that you originally had worked on, and I think that's not, when people were voting, they voted to, only to restore, protect, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forest, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife.
So I've got a question then, Representative Hansen. When the Forest Legacy was negotiated and paid for with amendment funds, because you were protecting and enhancing by getting a permanent easement for conservation, you then as well included access as that bundle you referred to it as. So how would you attribute that for the payment that you made to those companies, how would you allocate that? Would you say that the enhancement was 100% and that the access was free? Or if there was any allocation at all given to the hunter access, then how could that be that we actually gave that allocation? And what would... If I challenged you to that question, how would you answer it?
Mr. Chair, my first response was I didn't negotiate the easement, but I think if you look at the easement, when you break down the easement, the eased value or the purchase of the hunting rights is not identified as a line item in that purchase. You're purchasing the rights in total, and that was a negotiation with the DNR for this. So you didn't separate out those rights. That is a right. There were other rights that were retained by the landowner that were not negotiated into the easement. Some of those, which I personally think we should have tried to purchase in that. But that line for hunting access or fishing access, to my knowledge, was not a separate purchase, like we're going to pay X dollars for the purchase that prevents a house from being put on this property, and we're going to provide Y for the hunting access. And Mr. Becker could correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Mr. Becker?
Mr. Chair, I agree with Representative Hansen. And I want to point out that the facts around the UPM Kemeny easement are a little different than the facts around this bill. The land in the UPM Kemeny easement was enrolled in SFIA, which provides for access during the period of the program. And the payment for the easement included, at the time of our review, $9 million in private match. So it's questionable whether the appraisal took into account the access issue, and if it did, whether or not the state paid for it. In all probability, not, with the $9 million in private match.
Okay, further questions? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Becker, thanks for being here and the work you do. I often thought that when Lessard Sams was having their discussions, much of your conversation centers around public access. It seems to be the commission finds that of value. Would that be a true statement, that if public access is part of what you're paying for? Some conservation easements oftentimes don't include public access. Is one of the things you look for, is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I believe that's in our priorities.
Okay, thank you. And then if I could ask again, along the idea of restore, protect, and enhance, as we look for properties that we hope would get restored, enhanced, protected, they may currently be in farmed and maybe are somewhat marginal or prone to flood, or we could use them to store water for whatever reason, or create wetlands. If we had a program that would allow the farmer to get additional money so they could enroll it in a CREP program or RIM or a WRP, if the farmer knew there's another opportunity out here to get additional money, potentially, maybe it'd be some Lessard Sams money, maybe it'd be LCCMR, it could be money additionally in the future, additional license money, but wouldn't it potentially, the farmer, have a better incentive to restore, protect, or enhance their land if they knew there was some additional money available from Lessard Sams to give them additional payments for that RIM, CREP, or WRP?
Becker.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I really don't know the answer to that question, and I think it would depend on the specific situation.
Mr. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just lay out some of the ones I'm familiar with. Say you take land out in Big Stone County, and it was had the potential to be enrolled in a CREP or a RIM or a WRP. If the landowner not only knew that, you know, that they were going to get some one-time payment, maybe it was permanent easement, they were going to get some one-time money, that wouldn't give them any money to pay their taxes ongoing in the future, maybe the next generation or whatever. And if they all of a sudden had an opportunity to get money that maybe would help pay the taxes or something, I would think that would be an opportunity for that landowner to say, this is another source. I would really think it's a stretch to say this doesn't help restore, protect, and enhance. This goes to, I believe it does go to what we voted for opportunities. I'm not saying absolutely this is tomorrow we should spend $10 million or $20 million, but this is the kind of stuff that people, this helps protect, I think, and it does. I mean, if you're going to give the farmer more money, there's more chance he's going to enroll it. I think that's the reality. And this gives them flexibility. Some of the farmers are nervous about enrolling in permanent programs forever, where this one, if it's got some kind of a time limit, I think potentially could be a benefit. And I heard over and over that a priority of Lessard Sam's is public access. This is public access because a lot of us, you know, can't necessarily afford our own little private hunting spot like some of us can. Other ones need to rely, and this is one more tool in the toolbox, and I would think that your group would think this does meet the goals. I think it's a stretch to say it doesn't.
Well, one of the things that strikes me in this conversation, and I saw as getting the biggest bang for the buck, at least it seemed to me, that using CREP and RIM and programs and adding on incrementally to that. But another thing, you know, I'm thinking about hunting opportunities, and if I lived in Lac La Parle County, I would want to walk in program for cornfields because you can't find a place to goose hunt hardly, or to shoot mallards on a field, or you can't find a good wheat field with 12-inch stubble to pheasant hunt in. And everybody always is focusing in on RIM and CREP, and not diminishing those, but there's also other kinds of land that should have payments on that as well. And if you go to South Dakota or North Dakota where I hunt, you find that all the time. I mean, you'll have a plots field I can't even remember what they call it in South Dakota, but plots in North Dakota, and it'll be a cornfield, and you go out with the dogs, and the next thing you know, you're taking pheasants in a stubble field. Now, I'm not saying that we use Lessard money to pay for that. That's not what I'm saying, but we shouldn't just lose sight of the fact that we're doing RIM and CREP and places that are set aside in, you know, those types of things. We also need other kinds of hunter access as well when you start looking at an overall program. Any more questions for Mr. Becker? Doesn't appear that there are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
People to testify for or against the bill? Any further questions from the committee? Oh, Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was waiting patiently for conservation groups or the agencies to provide comment on this. I'm waiting for the righteous indignation for raiding the funds. This is the first bill getting a hearing that takes the outdoor heritage funds and not a peep. And I hear that the Deer Hunters Association is in favor of it. So I look around the room at all these folks who testify elsewhere, or who comment elsewhere, or who write columns elsewhere about raiding these funds. And what do I hear on this? Crickets. Nothing. Nothing. Your silence speaks volumes.
Anyone like to testify for or against the bill? There being none, the bill as amended will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Hackbart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next item on the agenda is House File 3162, which is a bill regarding the U.S. Coast Guard and some problems that we're having here in Minnesota with regard to the Coast Guard. Chair will move the bill. And Tom Newstrom, are you here?
Yes, sir.
This is a resolution, members, to the members of Congress and the President and about anyone else who will listen. And we also have John Edmond here from the Explore Minnesota Tourism. Actually, why don't you guys tell the, I've been working on this or been involved in it for a long time. I actually have a six-pack Coast Guard license. I also have a license for 9 passengers and up and 53 gross tons or more on the Lake Superior and 49 gross tons or more for the Mississippi River. So I've had a little involvement in this. I got my license back in 1984. And so I know a little bit about this. This problem isn't a problem that I have, but a lot of people that don't have that licensure and don't have inspected boats or the Coast Guard insists on their boat being inspected are having havoc wreaked with them. Some people are falling through the cracks. Some people are not, and getting fines and a variety of different things. So I think what we'll do is have Mr. Newstrom and Mr. Edmond explain where they're at. I suspect that they're in support of this resolution to ask Congress to do something. In fact, I think that DNR met with Coast Guard today. I heard rumors. Is that true? Mr. Meyer, do you know anything about that?
March 10th.
Okay. So go ahead. State your name and for the record who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony on the resolution.
Thank you for allowing me to speak today also. My name is Tom Neustrom. I'm a professional guide from Grand Rapids, Minnesota for 31 years. When this came up, this information came up to us about us having to get a Coast Guard license, we were all confused. We were very, very confused. Even though we were told that the law has been on the books for 100 years, it's never been enforced. We're inland guides. We're not on a Mississippi River, Canadian waters. You know, we're not over on, and should I say, on the Wisconsin-Mississippi border where there is barge and ship traffic. We're inland. We don't see any boats bigger than 20 feet as guideboats, or we see once in a while a launch on Leech Lake or Mississippi or on Winnie, but that's very seldom anyway. The launch business has kind of gone away on those bodies of water. For us to go through the dynamics of the courses and the money that it would take to really for us to be licensed by the Coast Guard is kind of not applicable to what we do. And you know, you look at the hardship that it would create in the economic times, and I think that a lot of our guides don't guide more than 10 or 20 trips a year when you look at the entire state of Minnesota. But that doesn't mean that we don't have to have procedures, and we should have some type of procedures. We've talked to the state about this, and they are working on some type of meeting with the Coast Guard, and we applaud that. And we would like to be able to continue on with our job. We have great insurance. I have terrific liability insurance, and I've had it for 25 years. I think that there is some things that we need to look at to bring a little bit of, how would you say, a little bit more professionalism at times to this when we license these guides in the future, which I hope it happens, and maybe from the state. You know, the money that we look at that could possibly be raised in this thing could be really isolated in the programs in the state, and I honestly don't want to see our money, if we have to pay fees, go to the federal government. I think the state needs to get the money. That's where we do our business. That's where our passions are, and that's where the fishing is. But we also are partners with tourism, and you know, when you look at 200,000 jobs within the state that are tied into tourism and fishing, and you know, Minnesota is regarded as the best place to fish in the lower 48. We have the best programs, we have the best DNR, we have the best guides. And just in regards and to you people, I just want you to understand that we want to do the right thing here, but we also want to be treated as we are. We're inland guides. We're not border guides. We're not controlled by the Coast Guard. I've never seen a Coast Guard boat in 31 years, and I don't think that, you know, it would be fair right now to try to implement some type of legislation from them to regulate us.
Okay, Mr. Edmund.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll be relatively brief. I just wanted to, my name is John Edmund, and I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. And I just wanted to be here and go on record in support of this resolution. This was brought to the attention of the Explore Minnesota Tourism Council, which is made up of hotels and resorts and lodging properties all throughout the state. And they felt that this is important. People, as you all know, and as you know, particularly Mr. Chairman, people come here to visit our outdoors, and they come here to fish, and they spend money. And there's a lot of small businesses that depend on this resource of fishing. The guides that we're talking about here also provide a great service to the tourism industry in showing people the lakes and the waters of the state. And this law that was on the books by the U.S. Coast Guard just suddenly was starting to be enforced, and that's jeopardizing a lot of people that are making their living on the resources, not just those businesses, but the tourism industry itself. And we're just asked, we think this resolution is good to take a time out, to take a look at what is being enforced, what it's doing, because I don't think that a lot of the enforcement rules that are in place for these inland waters were really intended for the kind of lakes that we're talking about here. Some of the tests and the requirements just perhaps do not apply. We believe in safety. We believe in the safety of the guests, people that are fishing, the guides as well, but we think it needs to be done in a reasonable way, and on behalf of Explore Minnesota Tourism, we think the Coast Guard action on this in this regard is really hurting the industry, so we support this resolution.
Thank you very much. Have you had it reported to you or that to DNR enforcement or the commissioner's office a situation where there was ever a bodily injury while a fishing guide was entertaining a client?
Mr. Chair, I cannot recollect something.
As far as from my point of view, and I guide on a lot of lakes, and I know an awful lot of guides in the state. In fact, I feel like I'm representative of most of them, and I've talked to an awful lot of them. We have never had an accident with any related with a guide that I'm aware of. And I've checked even within our enforcement division and within our area and over west, and nobody seems to have any accidents that's ever happened where a guide was involved.
Well, Mr. Smith is shaking his head that he knows of nothing that's ever happened. Let me ask you a question, Mr. Edmund. What could this do to the Minnesota Governor's fishing opener, these regulations? Because I remember when we had the Governor's fishing opener in Crane Lake, and we had the Governor, and we're getting ready to have it in Kaptogama, and had it in International Falls, that we had, I don't know, at least 100 guides in boats and motors. Would that have any impact on the Governor's fishing opener? Let's just say it weren't on any of those lakes. Let's say it was on Leech Lake or Winnie or, for that matter, Red Lake, now that the walleye are back. Governor might be able to catch one there.
Well, Mr. Chair, I cannot really say how the Coast Guard will enforce it, but yes, it could, because as you know from participating in past fishing openers, the whole purpose of the event is to show media Minnesota's waters and lakes and the sport of fishing. And in that regard, what happens is that people from the local community, some professional guides, some people living in the area, some resorters, take out the media in their vessels fishing. We actually technically do not call them guides. They are hosts for that reason, to not necessarily flag that they are in fact guides. But I think if the Coast Guard did decide to classify them as guides and try to enforce it, yes, that would probably bring havoc to the event.
Remind me how many people that Tim Watson is getting organized for this year's Governor's Opener. In terms of guides,
there's probably a couple hundred guys.
Yeah, so it's a lot.
Yeah.
He whines about it, too, but he's enjoying every moment of it.
That's very good.
Well, this and one of the problems that I have with this whole thing is that it's not being, doesn't appear to me at least, to being enforced evenly across the area. In Ely, for example, it's being handled in one way in my legislative district. In Crane Lake and areas other than that, it's being handled in a different way. It's kind of a hodgepodge of way looking at it, and now the reports are growing into your area in Grand Rapids and even further west and north and to represent Purcell's district, and the phone is starting to ring and ring, and it's about time that we get in, that we do more in terms of engagement. So, and I know that the DNR is working on meeting with them and trying to figure out a way to get through this, because before I got in the legislature, I used to guide. I mean, that's the reason I have the license. We didn't have the choice, Mr. Newstrom, at the national park. I mean, they came along and they said, let it be written, you will go in there, and people got tickets for the first year or two because they were going in there without any Coast Guard license. And so in that instance, they came to our community, came to our church and our fellowship hall and sat down and they gave a class, and they came to International Falls and they went to Bedette and they gave classes and they gave the tests right on site. And when you passed the test, you got your license eventually in the mail, and we were able to work through that. But I also understand that there aren't any classes out there either to even try and comply with this. And I suggested to the, give me the name, which 9th District? Yeah, 9th District Commander earlier in this legislative, actually before legislature started, that they work with the Northeastern Higher Education District in the Arrowhead and the Arrowhead Consortium, and work something out through your community colleges so that they could use those facilities and come in. But we haven't apparently had any of that either. So it's a real problem. I'd ask that you support the resolution. Is there anyone here that would like to testify for or against it? Mr. Newstrom, you want to say?
Representative Dill, I'd like to ask you this question, too. When you took the test and when you went to the schooling, how much did it cost you?
It cost zero.
It's at a price right now of around $2,500. And that's with the loss of work, that's the licensing procedures, that's the testing procedures, that's the drug and alcohol procedures, the TWIC card. Plus, they don't even have the availability to do all this stuff within a reasonable part of northern Minnesota where we work. And that, you know, that's the thing. I mean, there's guys that had to go down to Chicago that got licensed in the Minneapolis area, had to go down to Chicago to take the test. Traveling, I mean, to me, and I don't mean to be pointed, I think it's irresponsible.
Well, we had in my community of Crane Lake, we had a few people that just said, we're not doing it. But yet they went ahead and guided and got tickets, and they ended up going all the way to Toledo to get theirs, to get their licenses, and they had to pay. But there was such an uproar in the communities from Baudette, basically your entire border from the Boundary Waters all the way to the angle, northwest angle, that they came and said, we give, we're going to put on these classes, we're going to get you the licenses. And the impact then was the insurance, because up to that point, not very many people had really commercial insurance that they could hang their hat on. The park forced that hand as well, which was a good thing. I didn't argue about that. But nonetheless, anyone else like to testify for or against it? DNR, you, Mr. Meyer, you got anything on this you want to tell us about?
I'll give you a brief update, but I think
that'd be helpful. Why don't you do that, and we'll go on to the next bill then.
Thank you very much.
You know, on behalf of the guides from Minnesota, I'm very humbled by you allowing me to come and speak here, and hopefully we can reach a resolution with this. And I got a good taste of government today, and I'll tell you what, it's been a long day, but I've got a lot more respect for what you people do. Thank you.
You related to Gordy Newstrom?
No, but I know him real well.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Edmond. Good to see you again.
Mr. Chair, members to the record, Bob Meyer, DNR. We have been working with your staff and Senate staff and Oberstar's office trying to come up with a quick, sensible solution to this issue. We have a meeting, as I mentioned, March 10th, hopefully with the 8th and 9th districts, to come up with a solution that will be developed for our region of the area, region of the country, that will make sense, hopefully take into many of the facts that Mr. Newstrom has brought up that don't make a lot of sense, frankly, the impacts or the barriers that are there. So we look forward to updating you on that as soon as that meeting's over. But what I understand is they're hoping to base something around our boat and water safety program, utilize that as a training, and then the drug and alcohol and those other pieces. Hopefully we can also already, there's things going on out in D.C. with a TWIC card. Hopefully that continues moving forward. And then once, it's my understanding what the indication I've heard is that once you submit your payment for this process, they will consider you in compliance. So our goal, and I know you've saw it, a copy of the letter we sent to the commander of the Coast Guard several months ago, about a month ago now, that I understand how the response is on its way. We want an expeditious system in place well before the fishing opener, if at all possible. So I hope that we can get this resolution passed and on the desks of people out in D.C. to see this, to help us deal with that so we can have it taken care of well in advance of the fishing opener in May.
Questions for Mr. Meyer? The only thing, I got a couple of calls last week, late in the week, and then this morning on the way in from outfitters and guides that said that the 20-foot length that's being discussed presently is not adequate, that they used their tow boats for guiding and for doing tows, and they need to be 22 to 24 feet to accomplish that. And so just give you that information.
Mr. Chair, we will talk more about that, maybe motor sizes if we need. We'll try to figure out those things, but I will get something set up with you to prepare ourselves with your concerns for our meeting on the 10th.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Any further? We're going to have, because it's a resolution, we can't lay it over. We'll have to vote it out. And we're going to Kent's committee, right? So the motion is to recommend it to pass and go to the Environment and Policy Oversight Committee. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, the next bill is the Intermediate Timber Auction Sale Provisions. House File 3202. And members, this bill is before us. This bill has been modified, I think, a couple of different times. I'm suggesting that we've got one thing that we need to work on, and that's the word logger, and it's on line 1.20. The idea of intermediate timber sales is to, why don't we have Mr. Tomlinson, are you still in here? Owen, you want to come up here? For the edification of the members, why don't you give us the rundown on intermediate timber sales, and then we'll tell them what we're changing, proposing to change.
Mr. Chair, my name is Olin Phillips. I'm the section manager for the Forest Management Section, which includes the timber sales program for the Division of Forestry, Department of Natural Resources. The legislation that's being proposed here is within statute. We have restrictions on the access, the ability to bid on certain sales that are called intermediate sales. And what the whole original purpose of this legislation was in statute was to make sure that large companies were not able to dominate the bidding process because of having a much more financially secure and larger finances available to them to go into the auctions and essentially buy up all the auctions. So we have a structure where we have a regular auction procedure which is open to anyone to bid. Generally the sales are a little bit larger, and then we have these intermediate auctions that we make available to those currently under the legislation that have less than 20 employees, seasonal or part-time. We've run into some discussion of this recently by some of the chairman's constituents and others as should we be improving upon this bill, and also just how do we document this? Currently, the Division of Forestry does not have access to corporate numbers that are provided for them, and we have essentially a self-certification process that has confused a few people that on intermediate auctions about their ability to purchase by having subsections of their business essentially doing the logging while other sections may be doing construction. And so which part gets considered in the 20-employee process? And I think your bill, Mr. Chairman, helps to move some clarification to that and does, I see, move to change the number. Really, from our perspective on the number, as long as you're somewhere below 100, you're not allowing major forest industries to come to bear on this bidding procedure at oral auction.
Okay. One of the things that was referenced was a constituent of mine. It's actually a constituent of Representative Anzell's.
Oh.
Sorry. He's so close that it nobody really knows. But anyway, they have a very successful construction, concrete, gravel hauling. And in the wintertime, he decided to go into the logging business some years ago so that he could keep his core employees working year-round rather than putting them, like it's traditional, putting them on unemployment. So he had always been allowed, for better or for worse, to bid in these intermediate sales until recently it was determined that he had more than the 20 employees, but he only had like 15 employees in the logging, let's call it a division. And since there can't be any, at the present time, there can't be any reporting from Dolly as to what he pays in workman's comp, for example, the department, so that they can figure out how many people are actually working in the logging part, which this bill will change in the last section. That is prohibited from them getting that information. They were advised, and rightfully so, that they couldn't bid any longer on the intermediate logging sales, even though they only had 15 or thereabouts, less than 20 people working in the woods. And so it occurred to us that we should probably raise that. What ended up happening was is they ended up forming a second company so that they could actually bid, put the 15 employees into that other company, another corporation, as I understand it, another tax return, another audit, another set of insurances, all these things just so that they could bid in these important sales to them and important to us in the terms of the state, because we're having enough trouble selling timber the way it is right now with the market the way it is. We need people to buy these smaller sales and get them cut and get them to market. So they were able to maneuver in such a way and working with the department to figure out a way to get it done, and it brought up this bigger issue. Now, one thing that we do have trouble with in the bill as written, and what I'm asking the committee to do today, is when we lay this over for possible inclusion into House File 2954, we're going to have to do a little more work on this down here on line 1.20 where it says working as a logger. And I'm going to have Mr. Brandt come up and give a little explanation of why that language becomes problematic by adding as a logger into the language. And I think you'll get a flavor of what we're up against. And I'm not absolutely positive that there's a perfect way to do any of this. So having said that, Mr. Brandt.
Mr. Chairman, Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Our members are loggers, truckers, and allied businesses from throughout the state. Chairman Dill's bill, as he points out, on 1.20, needs a little bit of work. As it's presently drafted with the working as a logger clause, Boise Cascade, UPM that was mentioned relative to one of the previous bills would be able to bid on these sales because they don't employ any loggers. All the logging is done by independents. So this language doesn't really work. Our advice to the committee would be to simply delete the clause rather than to try and further define something in there. And the reason that we would argue for just simply leaving the existing language in statute as it is these small business set-aside, in essence, sales were first passed in 1981. And there are a number of small, particularly hardwood sawmills around the state with two or three employees. Representative Saylor's district's got a bunch of them. Representative Purcell's, Representative Dill's, Representative Anzell's district has got those. And those folks have traditionally been in here. They're small businesses, in some instances smaller than many of our logging businesses are. So we would just encourage you to leave 1.20 as it is. Kind of think that trying to refine that further may just have more unintended consequences. We would agree with the chairman wholeheartedly on 2.3 that the DNR should have access to that information from the Department of Labor and Industry to make determinations. And whether it's 20, whether it's 30, whether it's 15, whether it's 40 as the number, you got people that get close to the edge on that, and whether they're in or out, they care about. But in terms of the overall for the industry, I don't know that going from 20 to 30 is a material impact for anyone. And might, prevent the situation that Chairman Dill highlights with people establishing separate corporations. I mean, there are some folks that have some loggers that have their businesses structured with the trucking as a separate corporation. I don't know that that's entirely to get into the intermediate auctions versus they may do contract trucking other than just hauling their own wood. They have some insurance or other liability concerns that are out there. So 1.19 is fine with us. We would suggest deleting the new language on 1.20 and think that 2.3 and thereafter is a significant improvement.
Anyone, thank you very much. Anyone with questions for Mr. Phillips or Mr. Brandt? Anyone? Well, I'm just doing some quick adding. 20, stand by just a second. That's 6, 7, 487 purchasers of timber. And I'm not sure, as of 2010, 487 business purchasers or individuals qualify for 30 or less, and 25 qualify for 30 or more. So that's the split. So by going to 30, we catch many, 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 many. And the truth is 424 of those purchasers are 0 to 5. So, I mean, this thing is really weighted in that first 0 through 30, and that's how we kind of came to 30, is that when you get to 31, you go to 2, and then 41 is 5, and 51 is 2, and 61 is 0, and it's 1, 1, 1, 1, and then 13 for 100-plus, and I assume that's mills.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that there's anything magic about any of the numbers. I spoke with the committee administrator for former Senator Ouellette, who championed this provision of law back in 1981, and his former committee administrator said, gee, I don't know, Jerry just decided that that was the number.
That's the way that happens around here. So what I'm going to do, members, is we'll lay the bill over. We're going to leave in on 1.20 as a logger. And before the bill comes back as a part of 2954, and when we do 2954, we'll have figured out. Oh, okay, so we're going to send it in 2954, which is the next bill, over to Kent's, and we'll have the over to Representative Eakins. And we'll have either take that out in that committee, or we'll have the fix, which it sounds like the fix is going to be harder to do than it'll probably just be taken out. So any questions on that? Okay, all in favor? Well, we're just laying this over for 2954 possible inclusion. Thank you very much. And you might as well stay up here.
Might as well.
Nolan. The next bill is House File 2954. And this is the, I'm going to call it the forestry bill, the DNR agency forestry bill, plus or minus possible a few items that we haven't agreed on yet. So why don't you go ahead and explain the bill? This is nice to have the author of the bill have the DNR explain the bill. You might as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think most of you have the little policy sheet as a kind of a brief overview of the bill rather than specific language. And there's several disparate things that are kind of, it's kind of like a technical update bill for several programs here that we're dealing with. The first that is addressed on the in the bill is regarding burning permits. And right now, currently under state statute, wherever there's any open burning other than a campfire or else a burning barrel during certain hours of time or else when there's snow cover on the ground, you're required to have a permit. As we've gone through some of the kind of measures of adjusting and reprioritizing our budgets during the lean time, we have been forced to move some of our forestry resources out of the agricultural zones of the state and more concentrate them where the mainstay of our work is. Those staff in the past have helped to assist in the delivery of the permit system, a paper permit system. And what we have done is we've looked at this and has started to say, where should we be in the future with our permit process? We currently have an electronic permit system, thanks to the support of the legislature and administration, that's in place that can be done over the internet or and then by phone calls. And now we're looking at potential in these some of these predominantly agricultural non-forested areas where there's not as high a risk of escape of for situations for burning permits that may offer damage to facilities or to people's houses or et cetera, that we would offer the counties in that area the option to decide whether they would like to pass a county resolution and essentially allow burning within certain periods of time during the day rather than having a written burning permit. And we kind of got a mixed bag down in the southwest portion of the state, which is the general area we hit. Some counties are currently assisting us in the delivery of written permits. They would like to retain that and continue to offer written burning permits through their system, and they would be allowed to do so. And we would essentially be open to requests from counties and our encouragement for some counties to move towards the non-written burning permit language. The second thing that's addressed in the bill on line 232 on the second page is the permanent tree and brush open burning sites. This is kind of just a tweak to the language here to make sure that it's clear we currently have the ability to manage these permanent burning sites well within the control, but we wanted to clarify the expectations there to those that are opening these sites, and that clarification really is in in line 3.9. And in that line there, you see a general description of the materials to be burned, including the source and estimated quantity. And we've added dimensions of the site and the burn pile areas, hours and dates of operation, and provisions for smoke management. This kind of takes these burning permits and also puts them under the restriction that that burning will be modified even during snow cover periods. One of the reasons we've done this in the past is we face some major wind problems where we've had a lot of waste wood come out that it really has ended up cheaper before some of our metropolitan burning facilities available to us, that it was just cheaper to burn the wood, and many of these communities therefore did not want to take the effort to process the wood because it could be done cheaper just by burning it. And some very large piles were burned that we felt that should not have been burned, and this would give us a little more ability for them to understand that and for us to manage how much material is allowed to be burned on these sites. We kind of shift gears in the next section, which is on line 3.22, and this is a charge for service received to the Special Revenue Fund. This deals with our private lands management program, which we were given authority by the legislature last year to start to charge and deposit those charges for providing management plans to landowners. And this is just to kind of tweaking that language to say that notwithstanding Section 16A.123, the Commissioner of Natural Resources may, by written order, published in the State Register, establish the fees the Commissioner determines to be fair and reasonable and that are charged to owners receiving services under the Subdivision 1. And so this effort is just to establish that as the process rather than having to deal with potentially rules, procedures, or other restrictions on the setting of cost for that.
Representative Saylor, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do have a question regarding the first part on the permission required in the counties having the authority to write burning permits in general. Two questions. Number one, I'm wondering what thought has been given to the potential, whether this will potentially contribute to more burning of unauthorized items such as C&D waste and other things that are not supposed to be burned according to burning permits. I'm just wondering if this is going to potentially contribute to that. And the other thing is, will this cost counties more? How will this affect county budgets as they're taking over managing the burning permits that formerly was done by the DNR?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Saylor, the first question is, the burning of prohibited materials is still prohibited. This doesn't lessen that. We would still have staff in the area, and a lot of that policing currently is done by the county sheriff's departments and the law enforcement people in the agency, as well as our conservation officers. There's really no intended reduction in that effort, and so it would still continue to be monitored there. The reduction in the forestry force there is only about 5 staff across this broad county area, so it's not, as it refers to the increased cost to the counties, I think it would, that this move to a burning period rather than a written permit would be greatly received by the counties, because many of them now are helping on their own behalf and at their own expense to provide written permits so that their people have access to it without having to drive to a DNR facility to get a permit. And so that's one thing. And also, in some counties, they are allowed to charge that administrative fee back. And so one of the counties does charge a sufficient fee to issue a burning permit that covers their costs. So they do have that availability to them, too, if they choose to provide a written permit.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I would just, referring to my first question, certainly like to encourage those in enforcement to look carefully at what actually does get burned, because I know it's tough to do, and as we're looking at cutting expenditures these days, not making them more, it's always a tempting situation to get rid of your C&D materials under a nice little burning permit, and I just, you know, hope that I know it's a challenge getting that enforcement out there, but it is an issue out in various parts of the rural part of the state.
Go ahead and do the bill.
Okay. Then if you'll the PFM fees was the last thing we covered on the that portion of the bill. And the next is a provision that we have in here on line 3.32, reoffering unsold timber. The purpose of really of this effort here is that as the economic downturn has impacted the timber industry, we manage a lot of lands. Sometimes often it's said that state lands are the poorest productivity over generality of forest lands in the state. The counties are a little step up, and then the industrial, and then the non-industrial private lands, kind of in the quality that way. So we have lands that we're attempting to manage through our timber harvesting processes, and sometimes they're just not an economical harvest. And so this provision allows us, once we have offered timber at an appraised value, to reoffer that at auction, and at auction only, where we would drop the price drastically to try to get the site harvested for a forest management purpose, where we need to renew that forest and get it started again. And rather than being faced with the cost of bringing in equipment to site prep the site and having to pay for that to be done, we feel that in some cases we'll be able to drop this price and allow the wood to be harvested and utilized probably more broadly for some of the biomass operations that we may see, but also to kind of sort the cordwood out and utilize the biomass. And that's the goal of that procedure. We have got some older legislation that's been around for a long while, and if you look at section 4.4 line there, auction sale procedures, we're suggesting a change down in 4.27 there. And the purpose of this change is right now when we offer a sealed bid auction process, the current legislation says that within 10 business days of receiving the written notice that you have to have a payment to the Division of Forestry, and that payment has to be formally received. That used to be that they would drop it off at our field offices. You know, the world's changed a lot since then, and our loggers are busy, and so we've run into a couple of problems with this of really just mistakes. Time has slipped by, dates have been missed, and then there's some kind of unreasonable punitive penalties associated with missing that time allotment. And so what we're suggesting is that when a length of 14 days from the time the sealed bid is opened, and one of the other changes we're looking at here, that kind of sets a standard period. The person that applies their bid is going to know that it was opened on a certain day that's put out in advance. They'll be able to know the 14 days from there. And we also offer here the provision that it may be postmarked by that date, so it doesn't have to be hand delivered to us, so a logger doesn't have to leave his logging activities or her logging activities and go and bring us a check at the last minute, that they can just have that postmarked. We felt if it was good enough for the IRS for taxes, it was good enough for our timber permits, and was a reasonable flexibility to offer to those out there.
Mr. Phillips, can they do electronic fund transfers to pay for that?
Mr. Chairman, not as yet. Right now, it's still by a check process, really. That would be something to look at in the future, too, but I don't think our system allows it at this point in time. The second part of this change to the auction sale procedures is in an effort to try to improve the climate for the purchase and harvesting of timber, which the chairman referred to as being in a somewhat difficult time. One of the biggest struggles faced by our loggers at this time is trying to get the secure these down payments to get loans or bonds to secure the timber that is required under state law. Currently, we have a procedure that says that when you go to an auction and the prices are bid up above the appraised value, then you have to give us a second check for the above the appraised value matter, even if it's just a dollar. And it's kind of another one of those sticking points, because it carries a penalty if you don't get it back into us. And we really looked and re-examined, do we really need that level of security? We think that the regular down payment is sufficient, except when there's a large bid up. And one of the concerns we would have, and the reason that we put this factor of $5,000 bid up in here, is because You don't want people saying, well, I really have a limited exposure. I can just bid this process up and not lose much money, and essentially dominate some of the bidding processes for that. So what we've suggested is that we will no longer require a bid guarantee, as it's called, unless the bid increases in excess of $5,000 of the appraised value, which we felt was substantial, was enough for, felt worthy of writing a check. That ends up to be about the $750 check that they would have to write, and that's a reasonable to cover the cost of processing, et cetera. And that's kind of why that number was picked. And that, then we have the repealers down here, that we're repealing two sections of the current language that was passed. One is a section in 90.172 deals with annual reports that are required to be provided to the legislature and executive council on the timber sale activity and timber permit holders. Currently, we have a very, thanks to the support of the legislature in implementing it, a very strong electronic system. We can give point and time accurate information on any of those upon request, and we just felt we probably passed the time that we need to be providing an annual report of this type that doesn't seem to be broadly used or broadly referred to, and if that information was required, we could provide it. And then the second repealer there deals with the lease pilot, management lease pilot project that was put forward. We felt that last year and last session, as we tried to implement this process, we've run up the feedback of some limitations in the language of being allowed to be effective, and we feel that really at this point in time that language, kind of our best approach to it was just to repeal it and maybe need to reanalyze how we started that.
Questions on the bill? Being none, the chair will move the 2954A2 amendment, and that goes to the last repealer. The amendment does, on line 1.6, it eliminates the may lease up to 10,000 acres, replaces it with 20,000 acres, and also allows for, it says no person or entity may lease more than 20,000 acres. So I read the report. I'm not confident that this, maybe we have to make it higher than this yet, but 20,000 to give them a little more elbow room to possibly find an industrial customer that would want to do this, or some biomass company or some organization. Now, it's been in 8917 under leases and permits under Minnesota statutes, it has been alluded to me from the department that they can already do this. But the biggest problem I see with this language is that this allows, says, no such lease or permit for a period extending of 10 years shall be granted. And in this bill, it goes to 21 years. And I believe the origin of that had to do with ag leases of some nature. And it may be that at some point we have to revisit that part of the bill and look at the acreage and the length of time that people would enter. But the amendment, as it stated, lifts the cap of 3,000 per one leasee and says that they can lease up to 20,000. So discussion on the amendment. And it also removes their repealer from the bill.
Mr. Chairman, we feel that you're trying to address the issues that we felt were a concern in this continuing forward with the legislation as it was.
And I, on building on that, I'm not sure that this gets us there yet, yeah. But it's another step out to try and find a threshold where we can actually do something. And the idea here is let's just give you an example. Let's just say that, and I'm going to pick this. No one has come to me, no one has said this, but I'm just going to use this as an example. No one has requested this, but let's just say where you have a lot of commingled lands, I'm going to pick the Cloquet Forest. There you have a lot of commingled lands, county lands, state lands. Well, the state could go to the county and say, we'll manage all of, you manage all of these lands, or we'll manage all of your lands, and in trade, we'll go somewhere else and do the land management in that area so that we can be more efficient, so that our 20 and your 40 make 60, and over here your 40 and my 10 make 50, and we can do a better job of this by entering into this co-management. arrangement. And that's one of the ways that I'm thinking that this might be helpful. And maybe it won't be helpful at all. But I don't want to just throw it out totally without trying to work on it in accordance with your report. So any further questions on the amendment? All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. All right. Any further questions anyone like to testify for or against the bill? House File 2594, or 2954, I'm sorry. There being none, I'll have one other oral amendment, House File 3202, which was the bill we did a bit ago on the intermediate timber sales that Mr. Phillips explained very well and Mr. Brand explained quite well, that be amended into House File 2954. Any discussion on that amendment? Being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails now to House File 2954 as amended. Chair recommends the bill to pass and be referred to the Committee on Environment Policy and Oversight. Any discussion on the motion? Being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and we are adjourned.